Greetings and welcome to this week's edition of the Mr. Science Show, the podcast where science meets pop culture. And this week we're talking about another demotion of everybody's favourite astronomical body, Pluto. You may remember that not that long ago, Pluto was a fully paid-up member of the Planet Club. However, a few years ago, the International Astronomical Union decided to demote Pluto to a new class of astronomical body called dwarf planet. This week I spoke to Dr. Charles Lineweaver, a senior fellow at the Planetary Science Institute at the Australian National University in Canberra. He has recently studied the definition of dwarf planet, and by looking up at the stars and also at some fundamental physics, has come up with a definition of dwarf planet that could possibly mean another 50 dwarf planets, so Pluto will hardly be an individual anymore. I started by asking Dr. Lineweaver about the controversy surrounding the definition of dwarf planet and Pluto. I recently came across your fantastically titled report, The Potato Radius, A Lower Minimum Size for Dwarf Planets. And there's been some controversy about dwarf planets and what is a planet, and Pluto was famously demoted from planet to dwarf planet. What is this debate all about?
Well, I guess we scientists, we look up in the sky and we see things, and we divided things into, in 2006, the IAU, in its wisdom, which is the International Astronomical Union, these are astronomers from all over the world who meet, I think, once every 3 years, and we give names to things and classify things. And 2006 was right, there was a big debate about Pluto because a guy at Caltech named Mike Brown had discovered an object, which is now called Eris, that was larger than Pluto, not too far, too much further away from the sun than Pluto. And so, was this going to be a planet or something else? And so they decided, instead of calling it a planet, they decided to demote Pluto into something that's called a dwarf planet. Now, this is not unprecedented because in about 200 years ago, the largest asteroids in the asteroid belt were found, Ceres, for example, and people said, "Whoa, we found another planet." But then as they found more and more asteroids, they said, "Well, this isn't a planet. This is one of many bodies about the same orbit, and so we'll call them asteroids, not planets." Now, that happened 200 years ago, and people have forgotten about that debate, but it's very analogous to the one that's what's happening to Pluto right now. You find the largest object in a certain region, you call it a planet, and then you say, "Well, wait a minute, there are a whole bunch of other objects in that region as well." And that's what happened in 2006. Now, what the paper that we just published, or we just had accepted for publication, is about not whether the boundary between planets and dwarf planets, but this is the lower boundary of dwarf planets. How big do you get? How big are you if you want to make it into a dwarf planet? And essentially, that comes down to how big do you need to be in order to be round or spherical like a ball? And that's called hydrostatic equilibrium. And that's what we did. We analyzed that boundary, and I called that boundary the potato radius, because essentially objects that are smaller than the potato radius are shaped like potatoes. And when objects get to have the potato radius, they start to turn into spheres. And so this boundary or this transition from potatoes to spheres, I just called it the potato radius because every small object looked like a potato and every larger object looked like a sphere. And so I thought that was a cool and catchy name to it.
It's very catchy. I love it. And how do you go about deriving the potato radius? You can look into the sky and see potato shapes and sphere shapes, but you've gone into the maths of it to actually derive when something becomes a sphere and enters this hydrostatic.
Right. We did both. The simplest thing we did was to look at icy moons of the outer planets, so the moons that are orbiting Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune, and look at specifically at the ones that have a radius between, let's say, 100, 200, 300, 400 kilometers, and to see how round they looked. many of them, matter of fact, most of them, have already had pictures taken of them in which they are resolved as a disc, because you need to see that disc. And if the disc looks like a potato, then it's not in hydrostatic equilibrium and should not be called a dwarf planet. And, or rather, it's a little bit of a misnomer, because here I am talking about the moons of other things.
Yes.
So, in terms of hydrostatic equilibrium, they should set the scale whether they're orbiting a planet or not, and so that's why they can be used as a calibration of the potato radius. And so we looked at objects, icy moons in this size regime, and found out that, hey, when you look at these icy moons, if they're above a radius of 200 kilometers, they're spherical, they're balls, they're in hydrostatic equilibrium. And if they're less than that, they're smaller than that, then they're kind of, you know, they shape more like potatoes. And so based on this, just a quick and dirty look at these things, we said the potato radius should be about 200 kilometers. So that was one part of the study. The other study was, okay, let's derive this based on the physics. And so we figured out what the pressure is as a function of depth and the density of these things and how strong they are. These are all factors that go into the calculation. And lo and behold, the calculation came out with about 200 kilometers as well. And so here we have the icy moons telling us that that's the potato radius, 200 kilometers. We have the calculation telling us 200 kilometers. And then my co-author pointed out to me, he says, you know what, the radius that's now being used is twice this big. And I said, oh, is that right? And then I talked to a colleague up here whose job it is to monitor bodies and trans-Neptunian objects. And she is working with Mike Brown, who discovered this object larger than Pluto. But they've also discovered lots and lots of objects which have radius of 100, 200, 300, 400 kilometers. And it turned out that if this suggestion that we're making is taken seriously, then there would be 50 new bodies that are already known would be classified as dwarf planets. And then we said, well, if that's the case, then instead of having how many dwarf planets are there now? And there are only five. And so I said, well, that's inconsistent with the IAU's classification system, at least if we're right about this potato radius. And so that's what the story is, that we have found that the lower size limit of dwarf planets should be half as big as the one that's being used now.
It's a fall from grace for Pluto, isn't it? From a fully fledged membership of the Planet Club.
Well, there are two ways to look at it. One is, you know, the classification of being a dwarf planet is like an elite club, and as long as there are a few members, it's elite. But it's kind of like the Qantas Club, and then you're a member, and you think you're all elite, and then, boom, in come a bunch of people who, you know, the price went down, and the whole airport is coming into the Qantas Club.
It's a great analogy, actually. I always thought being a member of the Qantas Club would be great until they made me a member, and then I thought, no, I don't really want to be a member of a club that
right.
invites
they're,
me.
If they're making me a member, they're making so everybody else a member, too.
That's right.
What's the quality of the food going to be if they're letting everybody in? But that's one way to look at it. But there's another way to look at it. You know, hey, Pluto's kind of lonely out there with four other dwarf planets, but now that it's got 50 friends out there, it's got a lot of other things to do. You can look at it that way, too. These emotions are really inaccurate guides of how we should understand the solar system.
So would all these new dwarf planets be trans-Neptunian objects? Are they all in the far reaches of the solar system?
Yes.
Okay. And do you think there would be a better way to classify dwarf planet then, if this is the implication, or is it just the way it is?
Well, I think it's just the way it is. However, it's not something that has been accepted yet. I mean, right now, I should mention that the trans-Neptunian objects that have been discovered, their sizes are not well known. We just have estimates of them. That's because, as far as our telescopes right now are concerned, we can see them as points of light, and we estimate their sizes from how bright they are, not from how big they are in our telescopes, because essentially they're just points.
Mm-hmm.
So we can get estimates of how big they are, and then using those estimates, classify them. And that's what I'm talking about when I say there's 50 known objects whose estimated radiuses, or radii, are above this 200-kilometer limit that we think that should be used, rather than the 400-kilometer radius that is currently being used.
It's very interesting. I was thinking about this on a related topic. I think just recently, I can't remember the exact details, but they discovered a planet which was so big that it was almost a failed star, and they didn't know whether to define it as a planet or as a star. Do you think that the definitions of planets and astronomical bodies, they're very much based around our solar system. Do they work on other solar systems?
They work if they're based on fundamental physics. Now, you just mentioned the distinction between a planet and a brown dwarf and a star. Now, for example, if you take a Jupiter and make it bigger and bigger and bigger until it gets to be about, about 13 or 15 or 17 Jupiter masses, then it becomes what's called a brown dwarf. And if you make that even bigger and bigger and bigger until you get about 80 Jupiter masses, then the brown dwarfs turn into stars. And the reason they turn into stars is that they start to burn hydrogen in their cores. So that's a very fundamental physical distinction when a brown dwarf turns into a star, because it starts burning hydrogen. Now, the difference between a large Jupiter and a small brown dwarf is that brown dwarfs at the beginning of their lifetimes burn deuterium. Deuterium is a little bit easier to burn than hydrogen. Mm-hmm. And so there, again, is a fundamental distinction that is used to separate the word planet from brown dwarf and brown dwarf from star. So those are distinctions that have nothing to do, really, with our solar system, but have to do with the temperatures and pressures needed at the centers of these objects in order to have deuterium or hydrogen go through nuclear fusion.
And I guess that your work on dwarf planets is calculated from fundamental physics, so it should work. So it should
that's
work
right,
everywhere.
That's right. That's because what we did was calculate how much gravity do you need to deform material of a given what's called compressive strength, or just the strength of the material. So the stronger the material, like iron or titanium, the harder it is to deform into a sphere. And so, according to our calculations, the icy moons should deform into spheres when they have a radius of 200 kilometers, but the rocky, not moons, the icy objects, and rocky objects should become spheres only when they get to be 300 or maybe 350 kilometers in radius. So there's a difference between whether you're made out of ice or made out of rock. One thing that we're talking about here is that as science makes progress, occasionally we need to reclassify things and shift our classifications. But in some sense, nature is a continuum, and some of these words are a little bit arbitrary. But just like hydrogen-helium fusion criteria, the idea of being round or not is something that's valid all over the universe, and so this is not just an arbitrary, semantic game we're playing. It's whether the gravity is strong enough to make something round, and that will be the case whether we're talking about the planets around Alpha Centauri or any other planets in our galaxy or any planets anywhere in the universe.
Actually, now you mentioned that, then I guess the definition of what a planet is it needs to have cleared its area. Or words to that effect. Are there some fundamental laws of physics that could be used to shore up that definition as well?
Yes, there are. It's based on, if you have a debris disk, it's called an accretion disk. When stars form, they always have accretion disks around them. And if you have a lump of material in that accretion disk, it starts to gather material. If material falls onto it, if it's really big, it can gather lots and lots of hydrogen and helium and turn into what's called a gas planet. But our little Earth did not have enough mass early on, and so it was unable to form a gas giant. Luckily for us,
yes.
The Earth is not made out of hydrogen and helium like Jupiter and Saturn, but is made out of rock. And you can look outside your window and you'll see rock. You won't see hydrogen and helium.
You mentioned in your report there are five basic shapes in the universe.
Yes, like that's a part of the paper that I think find really interesting, but that's been overlooked by almost everybody because of poor Pluto and the emotional attachment people have to Pluto. The different shapes, I divided every single shape in the universe into these five categories, and the small object category is, I mean, you'll see in front of you a pen and a telephone and a piece of paper and a tree, and these are all objects whose shapes are determined by the forces between atoms. Or between molecules, and so not by gravity, but by electronic forces between the electrons in one atom and the electrons in another atom. And so there's all kinds of crazy shapes, and I call that just dust, because dust is all kind of crazy shapes. But if you then increase the size of anything, whether it's a piece of paper or a pen or a tree, if you increase that size and get more and more massive, try to keep it the same shape, you won't succeed because the self-gravity will pull the thing into a more or less rounded shape, which looks like a potato. And then you increase, so those are two shapes now. We have dust, and now we have potato. Now, potato is where gravity has started to become important compared to the electronic forces, right? So you have weird, dusty shapes that are on the small scale where electrons dominate. Then you have where gravity and electronic forces are about the same. You have things that are kind of roundish, like potatoes. And then you get even larger, more mass together, and then you just have spheres. So those are three shapes, dust, potatoes, and spheres. Now it gets a little bit more complicated. There are two more shapes. One is disc shapes, like the disc around Saturn's rings. Well, Saturn's rings are a disc. Or the plane of the solar system. You know, all the planets orbit the sun in a disc. And if you look at galaxies, you'll see disc galaxies. So discs are objects that have a lot of angular momentum compared to how much, velocity, how much dispersion of their velocity there is. They have not been able to get rid of angular momentum, but have been able to get rid of their energy.
Yes.
So these are things that are going around and around in the disk, like the rings of Saturn, like the disk of a galaxy. And so these are high angular momentum, we call them. Now there's another kind of object called a halo. Now, these are halos are basically spherical, but they haven't collapsed like the sun and the earth and the moon or all the other planets into spheres, but rather they're made out of discrete objects like stars, and these stars are orbiting, going around and around, and they're forming kind of like a swarm of bees. So, but they are also spherical. So those are, I wouldn't call them spheres, I'd call them halos. Because of their swarmy nature.
Yes.
And clusters of galaxies are also similar. Instead of having stars swarming around, you have galaxies swarming around inside of a cluster. And these are spherical objects. So you have halos, disks, spheres, potatoes, and dust. And those are the five categories that you can read about in the paper if you have a careful look at it.
Yes. Well, it's a good read. I enjoyed it.
Good. Got nice pictures, too, doesn't it?
It's got fantastic pictures. Well, that's all we have time for in this week's edition of the Mr. Science Show. My name is Mark West, and as always, our website, www.mrscienceshow.com. If you have any queries or questions about today's show or about anything that you might have heard in the past, or you have your own particular definition of dwarf planet that you like, why don't you let us know? Leave a comment on the website, www.mrscienceshow.com, and from there you can follow me on Twitter or you can email the show. My name is Mark West. Thanks again for joining me on the podcast where science meets pop culture.